for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Today, Republican Congressman Paul Ryan proposes a 2013 budget that would cut spending by nearly $5 trillion over 10 years. His plan would turn Medicare into a premium support program and repeal Obamacare. Senate Democrats will unveil a budget tomorrow that has very different priorities. It calls for higher taxes on the wealthy and new spending for infrastructure and education. Here in the studio to talk about two budget plans and prospects for compromise, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution, Chris Freitz of National Journal, and Vin Weber of Mercury, Clark & Weinstock. That's a bipartisan public strategy firm. Of course, you are always part of the program. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to see you. Chris Freitz, I'll start with you. Talk about this latest Ryan budget plan, what it says, how it differs from last year's version.
Well, sure. I mean, this is a very big, complicated document that Chairman Ryan plans to unveil later this morning. The summary alone is 90 pages. So I got an early look at it last night. And the big takeaways here are that it balances the budget over the next 10 years, which is a shorter time frame than some of the other balanced budgets that the House Republicans have put out over the last few years. And it does that by cutting $4.6 trillion in spending. That's all cuts. There's no new taxes in the Republican plan. And the biggest way that it does that is it repeals Obamacare. It completely gets rid of the entire program, and that's $1.8 trillion in savings. And some of the savings, it repeals, for example, the expansion of the Medicaid program for the poor and disabled. It eliminates the subsidies that would have helped people pay for health care insurance and the new exchanges that it would set up. The second biggest cut that gets to a balanced budget is what they call mandatory spending, and that's $962 billion in cuts. And these affect a wide range of programs that the federal government must pay for, things like food stamps, federal civilian and military retirement, farm support programs, welfare programs, unemployment insurance, flood insurance, student loans, Pell Grants, all these kinds of things. Very long list there. The food stamps, it would turn it into a block grant, and it calls for time limits and work requirements if you're on the food stamp program. Pell Grants, for instance, the kinds of grants that college kids get, it would freeze the maximum amount they could get at $5,645. So that's the maximum amount you could get this year would be the maximum amount you could get for the next 10 years. Medicaid is the third biggest thing on the cutting block here. That's $756 billion. And it turns Medicaid from a program where the federal government covers about 57 cents of every dollar that's spent in that program into a block grant, a lump sum that would just be paid to each state. And then fourth is the Medicare cuts. And that's the big one. We'll hear a lot about this. They get $129 billion out of that program. And this is implements what Republicans call premium support, but what a lot of opponents will call the voucher system. And it gives seniors a fixed subsidy and a choice whether they want to go into the traditional Medicare program or use that subsidy to pay for other private insurance plans. And it would also means test seniors, so the wealthiest seniors would pay more than lower income seniors. And then they also outline tax reform. So those are kind of the five big ways that the Republicans balance their budget here. And that's what we're looking at.
And not a single dime of new taxes.
That's right.
All right. Now, give us a sense of how Patty Murray's Senate Democratic budget differs.
Okay. And when I talk to the Senate Democrats up there, the sense is that there'll be $1 trillion in new revenue and $1 trillion in cuts. And they plan to unveil this plan tomorrow. So they'll come right after the Republicans.
Right.
And they've played their cards pretty close to their chest. But here's what I expect. I expect to hear a lot about a balanced approach. This is the Senate Democrats and President Obama's talking point here. And this means that they want a mix of spending cuts and tax increases to balance the budget. Budget Committee Chairwoman Patty Murray hasn't said it explicitly, but Senate Democrats I talked to say that they're not going to increase any more tax rates. What they're looking for is closing of loopholes, tax deductions, and that's in line with what President Obama has said. And one big loophole that the Democrats love to talk about is this corporate jet loophole. It was created back in the 80s, and it lets corporate jets be depreciated over 5 years instead of 7 years, and it costs $300 million annually. They love it because it's an idea that, if you own a corporate jet, you're very, very rich. Do you really need this deduction? Those are the kinds of things that they're focusing on. They say that none of their cuts would affect beneficiaries. And they think because House Speaker John Boehner, during the fiscal cliff discussions at the end of last year, put $800 billion on the table in potential savings of loopholes and deductions, that they can get there through those kinds of reductions. Patty Murray will also reverse the so-called sequester, those very deep automatic spending cuts that went into effect at the beginning of the month through her budget. Democrats will talk a lot about how that will help the economy. It will avoid, the 750,000 jobs that are predicted to be lost because of those spending cuts. And that is really what we should look for, is Democrats talking about how their budget will help grow the economy, and the Republicans' austerity is going to, put a halt on any kind of economic growth we've seen.
Chris Freitz, if I were your professor, I'd give you an A+. I thought that was terrific.
Thank you.
All right, EJ Dion, why is Paul Ryan going back to Obamacare? Isn't that a settled issue?
Well, when you look at the reports on the Ryan budget, it's like party like it's the day after the 2010 election and the 2012 election never happened. This is a very conservative, some of us might say reactionary budget. There are a whole bunch of things here that are going to raise questions. I think one is that he repeals Obamacare. And by the way, the Congressional Budget Office argues that the full repeal does not save money. It actually, if you repeal it, you add about $100 billion to the deficit. I don't know where those numbers are now, but it's not clear that saves you a dime. Secondly, Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney ran against the Medicare cuts in Obamacare in 2012. Republicans ran against the Medicare cuts in 2010. And guess what? Paul Ryan pockets those very same Medicare cuts to help balance the budget. This is, depending on your point of view, chutzpah, audacity, or hypocrisy. We can debate which of those words is most appropriate. The other thing, I think, and this is the fundamentally conservative or white right-wing nature of this budget. Ryan says he wants to get the top-to-income tax rate down to 25%. He wants to have two rates, 10%, 25%. If you're going to do that, you need to be a magician or have Harry Potter's calculator, or you have to eliminate virtually every deduction for the middle class and make a lot of cuts. It's going to be very interesting. He's not going to come out with the details right away. He's leaving that to Dave Camp on the Ways and Means Committee. I have great sympathy for Dave Camp trying to make that one work. And there are going to be deep cuts in programs for poor people. He talks about it as block granting, but there are going to be cuts in Medicaid, cuts in food stamps, cuts in Pell Grants. In the last Ryan budget, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a liberal group whose numbers are very respected, I think, across the board, said that at least 62% of the Ryan cuts came from low-income programs. I'm very interested to see how this new budget is going to score.
All right.
I just gave my dear friend Vin Weber a lot to talk about.
Exactly. And thank goodness Vin Weber got here, so EJ didn't have to give your side.
I was ready to give your side.
He's heard me give it so often, he probably does it better than I do.
So, Vin Weber, what happened to the president's mealtime coming together? What happened to the notion of we're going to find a way through this and compromise? This Ryan budget doesn't sound like compromise.
Well, I'm more optimistic than your question
okay.
is. And maybe more than EJ and Chris are in looking at this. I do not look at the process we're going through this week as a throwback or a continuation of the gridlock that we've been concerned about. Could end up in that. Paul Ryan has done his job. He's produced a document that House Republicans like. The good news is, in my judgment, tomorrow Senator Murray, a serious person chairing the Senate Budget Committee, is going to produce a Senate document. That's a big change in the process from what we've seen in the last 4 years. We're going to have these two competing and, no question, conflicting visions from Republicans and Democrats. And the first look of that is going to be, my gosh, they're so far apart. How can they ever come together? Well, but you have to start someplace. And in the past, we really never began that discussion. So in my view, I think it's going to be tough. I'm not Pollyanna-ish about this. But the way I look at it, and I'd be interested if Chris and EJ don't think the same way about this, but we've tried super committees. We've tried gangs of six. We've tried summits between the speaker and the president. And it hasn't worked very well. We've gotten, you know, sort of fits and starts, and we've gotten to some significant deficit reduction, but not in the ways that anybody like it. What we have the opportunity to try now is regular order. The Senate produces a budget. The House produces a budget. They get together in a room. One of my better friends, Bill Hoagland, one of the best budget analysts in this town, says, if we get Patty Murray's committee and Paul Ryan's committee together, we should sell tickets at the Verizon Center. But it's a start, and there are two serious people who could lead us to something.
All right. Vin Weber is former Republican member of Congress representing Minnesota's 2nd District. Short break here. We'll be right back. And welcome back here in the studio with me, Chris Freitz. He's national correspondent for the National Journal. Vin Weber, co-chairman of Mercury, Clark & Weinstock. That's a bipartisan public strategy firm. And E.J. Dionne, he's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of Our Divided Political Heart: The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. Before we go any further, I want to ask you, Chris Freitz, about the deficit idea, the deficit reduction. How important does it seem to be to Americans now?
I think it's been very important, and part of the reason that we've seen this issue leap to the forefront was the presidential campaign. And you saw that both sides put out their vision and talked about this problem. Generally, the deficit is not something that rates with people, and it has rated these last few years. And we had a political battle over that, both in the presidential and the congressional races. And when you look at the polling, it still is at the top when it comes to things people are worried about. And what's also interesting, if you dig down into that polling, is that the president's approach, this idea that a tax increases on the wealthy combined with spending cuts tends to be more popular than the idea of just slashing programs. Because while everybody says it's great, let's reduce the deficit, once you start reducing their programs, whether they're seniors on Medicare, whether they're food stamp recipients, whether they're people who just depend on a government service, that number plummets. It's let's balance the deficit, but don't do it out of my pocket. And
exactly.
That's the problem.
Ben Weber, just before the break, you heard E.J. Dionne say that Obamacare would actually reduce that deficit and therefore should not have been included in Paul Ryan's budget. Why do you think he did that?
Well, first of all, the GAO, a different entity, came out with a report, I think a week ago, that said that Obamacare will add $6 trillion to the deficit over a 75-year projection. So we don't, but we're required to project for 75 years on Social Security and other entitlement programs. So it's not clear to me which direction we're going in terms of it. I understand the CBO has marked it as a savings in the short term. But, the budget is, as we hear a lot of discussion this week, basically a political document. The Republicans, I will grant, of course, that President Obama won the election, but all the Republicans ran on appealing Obamacare. Should they get into office and simply say, no, everything I ran on in the last campaign, never mind, I didn't really mean it. They have to at least stake out the position that this is what they believe is right. And they do believe that we're going to have serious problems with Obamacare, which I agree with down the road, in squeezing providers too hard. We'll see what that's going to do down the road. And in maybe putting upward pressure on premiums and forcing people out of the private health insurance market, particularly in small businesses.
All right, Chris, I want you to add to that.
The idea of the Obamacare cutting the deficit, that's been out there a lot. And that's largely because when the House Republicans have passed their repeal legislation, they tried 30 times. They passed 30 different kinds of repeals right. In the last Congress that didn't go anywhere in the Senate. The CBO, which is the unpartisan, nonpartisan independent scorekeeper here in Congress, and they said the last repeal, which would have repealed all of Obamacare, would have increased federal budget deficits by $109 billion, and that was largely because it reduces the direct spending by $890 billion and reduces the revenues, all the new taxes in Obamacare, by $1 trillion, which leaves you the difference of $109 billion. So to say that repealing Obamacare increases deficits, well, it does,
but what? It increases deficits
by $109 billion, which
right.
Is,
over
which,
10
but then
years. So
over,
this
over
is
10
to be
years.
A budget. Look, there are a whole bunch of things on the table. I salute Vin for not trying to defend the particulars of the Ryan budget very much, because I think they're hard to defend. Secondly, I agree with him, and we can get to this, that there's reason to believe that there's a path out of this. And what I really agree with him on is regular order is a whole lot better than a whole bunch of fake crises and deadlines, which I think have come mostly out of the Republican House. But I hope we can put those days behind us and have a real budget debate. I disagree with Chris on one thing, which is he says that the deficit is the biggest issue on the minds of Americans. Actually, what the polling I've looked at over the last several years shows is job creation and economic growth is more important to more Americans than deficit reduction. And I think one of the problems we're having here is that we're focusing almost entirely on the deficit when we should be focusing on getting out of the economic mess. Nothing could help us more. And heck, this is an old conservative talking point. Nothing could help us more to reduce the deficit than economic growth.
And with all of these cuts,
we are going to endanger the recovery that finally seems like maybe it's getting off the ground.
And what do you, Vin Weber, and this is a tweet, what do you think of the Paul Krugman viewpoint that addressing debt and deficits can wait for a stronger economy?
Complicated question. In the very short term, which is a few years, I'll surprise everybody and say I don't disagree with Paul Krugman. Where I disagree with Paul Krugman is when he basically says we don't need to address the long-term debt problem for several years now, because that just says to me we're not going to address it. I agree with people, and I probably agree with EJ. The problem we have is not this year's deficit or next year's deficit, and that means the problem, in my view, is not domestic discretionary spending or even defense spending. The problem is long-term entitlement reform and revenues.
But
Paul Krugman doesn't acknowledge even that. He basically says
he
do not. But he says we put off dealing with it forever.
No, I think one of the issues
Jeffrey
about
Sachs took him apart pretty effectively from the left.
Yeah, well, I think one of the issues here is, do you need the kind of Medicare cuts that everyone is talking about? There is evidence. I mean, it's just a fact that healthcare cost inflation has been going down. Now, we don't know yet. We don't know yet how much of that is the recession and how much of that is changes in practice. There is evidence that some of it may be permanent. And the notion that we are going to make steep cuts in Medicare, throw some older people 10, 15 years from now under the bus before we actually know the size of the problem, I think is a big mistake. I think we do need some short-term deficit reduction that doesn't kick in early so we don't wreck the recovery to get us at a sustainable deficit. And I think that's the underlying argument here. There are those who say we need to deal with everything now. And there are those, and I'm in this camp, who say let's, with cuts and tax increases of around $1.5 trillion, well, which is a lot of money, but actually in the broad run of things over a decade, not a hard
including
to reach.
Including the $600 billion we got, or on top of that?
No, on top of that, if we get about $1.5 trillion over a decade, we
$2.1 trillion tax increases over the next 10 years.
No, I'm saying a balance. We can do a split. Obama's plan is about 50-50. You know, he raises almost six. It's actually tilts on the cut side rather than tax increase side. He gets about $600 billion out of tax reform.
How does he get cuts in social spending?
Well, the Obama does have some Medicare cuts. They are mostly not. They're mostly cuts in providers. He does a little bit of means testing for higher-income Medicare recipients. Very controversially, he changes the indexing of Social Security, and I think that causes him problems in his own party. Bernie Sanders, Harry Reid introduced a bill saying, wait a minute, we can solve the Social Security problem by lifting the tax, the cap on income where the tax is levied to somewhere around, I think it's around $230,000. That'll be a debate within the Democratic Party. But Obama has been serious about dealing with the entitlement problems without wrecking the programs.
Do you agree with that, Ben?
Partially. The president's come forward, as EJ pointed out, with some meaningful advances in terms of entitlement reform.
Right.
I would point out 107 Democrats in the House sent him a letter saying absolutely no to any change in entitlements. So you're right, there's a debate in the Democratic Party. The only good news about that is you still got 90-some Democrats that didn't say no. So you could get Democrats to vote for some meaningful entitlement reform.
But I
want to emphasize one last thing. EJ sort of passes over the fact that most of the president's Medicare cuts, not all the ones we're talking about here, most of them are coming from providers. That is not without cost. We seem to have this notion that if we're just nailing the doctors and nailing the hospitals and nailing the producers of medical devices and pharmaceuticals, nobody's worse off. That's the supply of healthcare. At some point, reductions in those payments will end up affecting the quality and quantity of health care.
So are you against cutting Medicare then? You know, that would be great. The point is you either do it there or you throw all of the burden on recipients and you reduce the coverage that people actually have.
We do have
a health care cost problem.
We're going to end up with some mix of squeezing providers, which Republicans won't like, and making it more competitive for consumers, recipients, which Democrats won't like.
Chris.
Democrats have been very cagey about what kinds of cuts they're going to expect, what kind of cuts they'll put on the table. They use a lot of adjectives, reasonable, responsible, but there's not many nouns and verbs about we're going to cut Medicare.
The president's been really specific, and Patty Murray's about, I think, to get very specific.
Well, she's about to get very specific, but that's why you have to watch tomorrow, because then you're going to see where are Democrats really as a caucus. And part of what the president was specific about in the fiscal cliff, he couldn't sell to Senate Democrats. Democrats. The idea that we would change the inflation on Social Security and decrease those benefits through that change, he couldn't sell it. He said it in talks with Speaker Boehner. National Journal had a big TikTok on this that we did right after the fiscal cliff. In those closed door talks, he couldn't sell it. So what we'll see tomorrow.
That's not why the deal fell apart, but that's another thing.
But the fact, EJ, is that Democrats have not been particularly clear about what they're going to cut, and we're going to see that tomorrow. The other thing that Vin points out about providers and the squeezing of providers, the Democrats in healthcare reform cut the Medicare Advantage program, which is a program that gives private insurance companies $700 billion to run a Medicare-like program. They cut that, and they said, we're going to put that money into traditional Medicare. After that happened, Republicans attacked Democrats for cutting Medicare.
Right. Which they shouldn't have done.
In this budget, Paul Ryan takes that same $700 billion, applies it to cost savings, and expects that Democrats aren't going to then turn around and say, well, you cut Medicare. So the idea that both sides are not playing games here is just a little incredulous.
I'm sorry. I just don't think that. I think there's kind of phony balance here. The president has come out with a proposal that includes some things his side doesn't like and some tax increases. And the Republicans are just unwilling so far to vote for any more tax increases. So this isn't a balanced thing. If Republicans would come to the table and talk about revenue increases, then we could talk about other stuff.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, hear what listeners have to say. First to John in Vernon, New York. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you very much. I just like to have some of the people around the table comment on how Obamacare has had two effects, particularly on this five-member family with a $57,000 a year AGI. The first thing is that the medical flexible benefits pre-tax deduction was halved, resulting in an increase in our income taxes and reducing our ability to pay increasing costs of health care. And if I'm not in the middle class and my wife and my family is in the middle class, I don't know who is. The second thing is that my wife works part-time, now has to look for another part-time job because companies like Walmart and the Olive Garden at the end of last year and the beginning of this year announced that they were reducing hours for part-time work below 30 hours. That's a 30-hour cutoff above which a company has to pay for health care benefits.
Right. Chris.
Well, I mean, those things were certainly in the healthcare reform law, and part of what we're seeing is that that law has not been fully implemented yet. And so the exchanges that are set up to help families pay for healthcare reform that will be state-run don't come into effect till 2014. So while a lot of the changes are being phased in, we've not seen the full effect, and will there be a balancing that will happen that once those things are implemented still remains to be seen.
To Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, David, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate your show.
Thank you.
I was just listening to the highlights, if you can call it that, of the Ryan budget ideas, and first of all, I think this guy's just unbelievable. But on the other hand, he is believable. It's socially and culturally and so forth, ideas like his are just so out of touch with what's happening in the United States in terms of immigration and ethnic complexity.
Okay, let's just focus, please, on the budget. Okay.
Well, that's part of the budget, though. His ideas in the budget are largely aimed at people who are not in his position in life. And I'm just really tired of hearing from representatives and senators who just don't seem to realize what the budget is like every day for people.
All right, Vin Weber.
Well, the previous caller had just told us what the budget was like for his income, $57,000 adjusted gross income.
Right.
And Paul Ryan, I would argue, is concerned about the costs to middle-income people of increasing taxes and complying with government programs.
But he's also, Vin, talking about cutting Medicaid,
absolutely,
cutting Medicare, making block grants available to states, and everybody knows the states have no money to begin with.
I understand that. I also understand that if – let's get back to the basic question. Do we need to do something about the long-term deficit in the country? You're not going to do it by not affecting anyone. I mean
– You by raising taxes.
Well, we're going to do some of it by raising taxes. We raised them $600 billion in the first of the year. My guess is if we get to a grand bargain, it will include another tax increase. I think, though, this is a different, off the topic a little bit. I think Senator Murray, who I really commend as a serious person – is going to have a hard time getting to $1 trillion in loophole closings. And that's what I'm told they're going to say tomorrow, is that we're going to raise $1 trillion in revenues through loophole
closings.
And we
have no idea what those are.
Well, first of all, we don't.
It's going to be hard without getting to some that are very popular and affect the same middle-class people that we're concerned about with spending cuts. You can't – you're not – if we could balance the budget by getting rid of the special deal for private jets, we'd all agree to do that.
But what about mortgages on upper-income people?
And Senate Democrats have said that's off the table.
Right,
they're not
exactly
talking about those kinds of things. And they're – and Senate Democrats will point to – Speaker Boehner, who said we can get $800 billion.
All right. And we've got to take a short break. When we come back, more of your questions, comments, and more of this discussion.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. By the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at langloth.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
One teacher's experience with a group of gifted Appalachian girls, how she tried to change their lives through literature and friendship. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. As we talk about a plan for a budget that's out there, Paul Ryan finally released his last night, so we've got a 90-page summary of that. Patty Murray on the Democratic side is releasing hers tomorrow, so we don't know exactly what's in that budget, but there's lots of speculation going on. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi. It's so great to have my call taken. I love your show.
Thank you.
I think it's the best one on the radio,
honestly.
And I'm not at all exaggerating. But anyway, I don't want to sit here singing your praises all day. What I did want to
ask. Oh, she wouldn't mind.
It's okay. It's okay. Go ahead, please.
But what I wanted to ask is, earlier I heard one of your guests talking about how we don't need to cut military spending. And I wanted to know how he can justify that when our military spending is breaching $1 trillion. We spend more than the next 20 countries put together. And the military also has a secret budget in which billions of dollars have just disappeared and we don't know where they're going.
First of all, if I said we don't need to cut military spending, I misspoke. What I said was, meant to say was, the entire focus of our budget efforts being on domestic discretionary spending and the military budget is misguided. I think we're cutting too much out of domestic discretionary, like National Institutes of Health and infrastructure, and I think we are cutting the military budget too rapidly and in an unplanned way. We are on a trajectory to reduce military spending. It's been happening since this president was elected. Secretary Gates put on the table some substantial downward path revisions in the military budget, and I think that that's appropriate. I think that we're not doing that cutting any smarter than we're doing domestic discretionary cutting. And it's partially just because of the sequester, but mostly it's because we're refusing to look at the long-term problem, which paradoxically increases our zeal to attack the short-term problem, which isn't that big a problem.
EJ.
I want to go all the way back to the gentleman whose wife has having her hours cut at Walmart. And I think this raises some real questions, which is, if Walmart is cutting people's hours rather than help them get health insurance, that says, A, something about Walmart, and B, it suggests that the problem with employer-dependent health insurance is very large. I mean, the way Obamacare was set up, it was intended to work with employers in the private market. If you have employers kind of undercutting the effort to expand health coverage, you're going to have more and more pressure for a solution like single payer. The second point I want to make about all these discussions of the Murray budget and the Ryan budget, I think there's one very clear difference, which is Paul Ryan says his budget is about cutting the deficit, but clearly his greatest interest is getting that top tax rate down. And who does the top tax rate hit? It hits the very, very, very wealthiest people in the country. The more you get that down, the richer you are, the more millions and tens of millions that you save. Murray is saying, no, that's not the way to go. In order to avoid some of these deep cuts, we are willing to raise taxes. And we're going to see what her trillion looks like. We know from Obama that if you simply put a ceiling on all the deductions at 28% instead of 39%, people in the top rates have to pay a little more in taxes. But that raises you already $600 billion. Now, the Senate Democrats may not want to go there, and we're going to see where they raise their money. But this is about as clear a choice about a way forward as we could get.
And what are you hearing, Chris?
I think EJ is right. This idea that Democrats are going to talk about the middle class. They're going to talk about how Republicans are protecting the wealthy and that their balanced approach is the one that is the best course for the country. Now, Republicans will say, of course, we want to bring the taxes down for the wealthiest. That helps small businesses. That helps people who generate jobs. That helps the economy, because that all trickles down. And that is the big discussion that we're going to have with these two documents, is that debate.
All right. Here's an email from Ted in Arizona, who says, didn't we just have a national forum 4 months ago, essentially over Paul Ryan's budget priorities versus President Obama's? Wasn't the decision rendered by the public a rather decisive one in terms of both the popular vote and the Electoral College tally? Has something changed significantly since the November election that would alter that?
No, and nothing was changed much by the November election. I mean, the fact is, we went into the November election with President Obama, a Democratic Senate, and Republican House, and we came out of the election with exactly the same configuration of players. I think that the president had some momentum because he did get reelected, although by a narrower margin than he was elected the first time. And I think at the end of the day, you know, the president is winning somewhat more than he's losing. He got a $600 billion tax increase as a solution to the fiscal cliff issue at the beginning of the year. That was largely a victory for the president. But the process, it doesn't, because you win 51.5% of the vote, doesn't mean that you get 100% of the policy.
But he won by about 5 million votes. He won an overwhelming margin in the Electoral College. Democrats, by all rights, should have lost seats in the Senate, given the configuration of seats up. They gained seats in the Senate. And they got 51% of the vote in House races. They lost the House because of a combination of gerrymandering by the Republicans. They happen to have the upper hand in more places. And the Democratic vote is concentrated in big cities. So you have an unrepresentative House of Representatives pretending the election didn't happen.
That's really too simplistic. I want to ask
you about that $600 billion because both John Boehner and Mitch McConnell keep saying the president got his tax break back in January, and that's all he's going to get, Chris.
I think that's very interesting, but part of what we've not talked about is the politics of what's happening here with these two plans. And watch President Obama today. He's going to the Hill. He's going to talk to Senate Democrats. He's going to talk to House Republicans, Senate Republicans, and he's talked with moderate Senate Republicans over dinner. He's on this charm offensive to try to build some kind of compromise.
It is helping,
and it was interesting to me on the Sunday shows that the number three Republican in the House, Kevin McCarthy, he said that if Obama is serious about entitlement reforms, then he'll like where we could go on taxes. And so that you're starting to see a little bit of movement from both sides. And you need to watch this week, aside from the theatrics of the president coming to talk, what I'll be looking for, there seems to be always this idea that, the president doesn't talk to any members of Congress. He doesn't have them for golf. He doesn't have them for dinner. He doesn't know how to deal with the Hill. And then he has some dinner and he has, some meetings and it's, look at this olive branch. And isn't it all bipartisan? What you really need to watch is the president and his staff starting to work with House Republican staff in a serious way to try to come together to a grand bargain this summer?
I agree with the broad trajectory. I think there is a chance for something like a real deal here. I don't think it passes through the House Republican leadership, though. I think what the president is doing is he has seen that there is a group of senators, some of whom really can't stand the defense cuts, like John McCain and Lindsey Graham. Others don't like government by crisis, people like Susan Collins and Mark Kirk, who say, all right, we don't want to be sort of held back by the House of Representatives. Let's see what kind of deal we can make with the president. And it's going to be a very tricky thing because he's got to keep Democrats on board, which is going to limit the amount that he can cut the retirement programs. Personally, I think that's a good thing. And the Republicans are going to have to agree to some set of taxes. But if the Senate were to pass a budget, a deal, and it went to the House, the Ryan budget's going to be helpful in the following way. There are actually a lot of Republicans, particularly in the Northeast, the Middle West, and the West Coast, who aren't really going to like the Ryan budget. They may not say a lot publicly, but they don't want to pass this budget.
Vin Weber, what would the House Republicans be willing to give up to get a deal? There's been some talk about Cantor's plan to merge hospital and Medicare and doctors' coverage?
Possible, but that hasn't extended a lot beyond the majority leader's office yet. I think that part of our difficulty in this discussion, and I think it's the right discussion, but we're in the opening round of a fight, which we hope ends up in a compromise, and we're saying, well, gee, how come Paul Ryan hasn't compromised with himself in issuing his budget? And the Republicans will say much the same thing tomorrow. How come Senator Murray hasn't compromised with
herself?
But
Obama has compromised with himself.
Well, he's the president. He ought to.
Well, Obama hasn't put out a budget yet. To be fair, he's late for the fourth time in 5 years, and this is the first time we've seen the president not put out his budget first. Congress has gone first for the first time in 92 years.
So where is Patty Murray going now?
She's going now because there is a requirement under the fiscal cliff deal that the Senate pass a budget. This is going to be the first time it does so in almost 4 years. And so she has to get something done by April 15th. So she's now statutorily required to put a budget out before the president. And that is something that we're waiting to see is what does the president
and
do?
She wants to get rid of the favorite Republican talking point, which is Democrats don't produce a budget. Now, what nobody says is it requires 60 votes for Republicans can block a budget, but it's also true that the Democratic caucus is far more diverse than the House. The Senate Democratic caucus is far more diverse.
Well, it's mainly true Republican that they didn't caucus. Produce a budget.
And, well, that's why she's producing one.
Right.
It doesn't require 60 votes to pass a budget, though. Just 50.
Maryland Representative Chris Van Hollen, who is a Democrat, released a statement today on the Ryan budget. He said, today, House Republicans released a totally uncompromising budget that simply represents more the same, undermining job growth, ending the Medicare guarantee, and slashing critical investments in our future while protecting tax breaks for special interests and the very wealthy.
It's exactly what I said a minute ago. The compromise, you don't begin with the compromise. And the Republicans are going to say this about Senator Murray's budget tomorrow.
Yeah.
The question is, and I think, you know, Chris talked about it a few minutes ago, has the president helped to create an environment in which we can go forward in the next couple of weeks and maybe try to bridge some of these huge gaps? And I think, you know, it's not assured by any means. These are big philosophical differences. I am more optimistic than I've been in a long time.
And how about you?
Yeah, I'm relatively optimistic as well, which makes me worry that I'm crazy, given that I lived here in Washington, D.C. for a long time. But I do think that the sequester is going to start biting over time. One of the problems with the sequester as an action-forcing measure is that a lot of these cuts take time to be felt. And I think school districts are going to feel them. I think that people in military communities that have Republican House members are going to feel them. And so the sequester is going to create some pressure. And I also sense in the Senate that there may be some Republicans who want to get off this sort of cycle of crises. And so we'll see. I think a lot hangs on what a minority of Senate Republicans are willing to do over the next month or so.
The sequester is going to probably start biting, but it's not necessarily going to bite in one direction only politically. I suppose people will say, well, the Republicans resisted a solution to the sequester. On the other hand, as time goes on, the management of the government in sequester is the administration's responsibility. And the president has seen a precipitous drop in his approval rating in the last few weeks, even though Republicans have not done well by comparison.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. All right, let's go to Indianapolis. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, my question is for your panel. In the news media, whether it's on MSNBC, CNN, they constantly refer to that $600 billion that one of your guests mentioned in tax revenue from the fiscal cliff as new taxes. Those aren't new taxes. That was restoring the old rates that were there before the Bush tax cuts, you know, back in 2003 or whenever it was. And that's not new taxes. Okay. You know what I mean?
That's ridiculous.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And in fact, fiscal cliff deal.
Well, why don't we raise the tax rates to 90% and say we're just repealing the Kennedy tax cuts?
Right.
At what point does the tax rate become the permanent tax rate?
The Bush tax rates were temporary. What the Congress did is it restored about 18% of the taxes in the original Clinton tax bill. It made permanent 82% of the tax cuts in the Bush.
That was 82%
a good thing. Of the Bush tax cuts, which means that we only got about $620 billion in revenue. Now, there's an argument among Democrats, was this a propitious time for Obama to make a deal? And I think it's a close question, because I was in favor of the deal because I thought it was important to start being able to support some revenue. However, he had more leverage when the entire Clinton tax increase would have come into effect than he has now. And now I think there's been some shift in the leverage toward the Republicans because cuts are on the table. And so the question now is, Obama's moves, I think, are all designed to try to figure out, can he shift some of the leverage back his way?
All right. So the final question, what are the chances for a grand bargain by summer?
I think there are chances for a modest bargain, a reasonable bargain. I'm not sure that we're going to have, and I personally don't think we need some whopping big 30-year deficit reduction plan. I think the chances of getting another $1.5 trillion in revenues and taxes, there's a reasonable shot of that.
What do you think, Chris?
I think it's reasonable, but having watched this now for 2 years, I have to be a little more cynical that they'll be able to get it done. Certainly with the debt ceiling going up and them having to deal by the end of summer, that is going to be the action device that forces these guys together. And if they can continue to talk before we get there and they're having conversations and throughout the spring into the summer, I think the chances increase. But if this is just a couple-week thing around the budget and then those talks fall off again, I think we're in for a lot more of the same.
I think we're in agreement. I think there's a better chance than we've seen in a long time because I don't think either party anymore sees it in their political interest to lurch from crisis to crisis. They can certainly give the speeches blaming the other party, but the reality is both parties have suffered from this. The president suffers when we reach an impasse and congressional Republican ratings could hardly be lower. Both parties see some benefit in getting to a deal. That doesn't get us there, but it creates an environment in which we have a greater chance of doing that than we have in many, many years.
It is being correct that the president's ratings have dropped precipitously in the last few weeks?
Maybe not precipitously, okay, but they certainly have dropped.
More than 5 points.
Right.
And the McClatchy poll out today says that a plurality of Americans trust the Republicans in Congress on the issue of the budget more than they trust the president.
And that's the last word. Vin Weber, he is a co-chair of Mercury, Clark & Weinstock. That's a bipartisan public strategy firm. Chris Freights with the National Journal. E.J. Dionne at the Brookings Institution, also a columnist for the Washington Post and author of Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. People have always said the show is very civil, very calm, very quiet. They all have another opinion. Thanks for listening all. I'm Diane Reed.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.